Welcome, everyone, to our month's craft writing workshop for Exponent 2. If this is your first time, welcome. If this is your 29th time, welcome. Tonight, we are so fortunate to learn from one of my favorite poets on a subject I've been dying to hear her speak about for a really long time, writing beyond warm fuzzies and really describing sacred experiences. In a way that simulates that without being overbearing or propaganda and all of that. And I'm so excited to learn from her. So welcome. Welcome. We are going to go ahead and just go over the agenda really quick. This is an
So we can
hour-long
have
session.
duloxetine and guanfacine.
We're gonna really try to stick to that hour. So I'll do a really brief introduction of Darlene, and then we're gonna jump right into her presentation. And we'll go ahead in about 5 minutes to the hour. We'll do a closing thoughts sharing, which is just a document that I share in the chat that has submission opportunities and also links to Darlene's books, and other ways that you could support Exponent or Darlene. And just as a reminder, because we've got a great crowd here, which is so exciting, if you could use your digital share hand, raise your hand when you have something to say, or if there's something that needs to come up, if you could just use that digital hand so that we make sure we see it, that would be great. And also feel free to use the chat. I will be looking over that as Darlene is presenting. So with that, here is a brief bio for Darlene. Darlene Young is the author of three poetry collections: Count Me In, Here, and Homespun and Angel Feathers. She's a recipient of the Smith Pettit Foundation Award for Outstanding Contribution to Mormon Letters. She teaches writing at Brigham Young University and has served as poetry editor for Dialogue and Segola Journals. Her work has been noted in Best American Essays, huge, and nominated for Pushcart Prizes. She lives in South Jordan, Utah, and we're so lucky to have her. I've got a copy of her second book right here, but my first introduction to Darlene was Homespun and Angel Feathers, and it blew me away. I've gotten a lot of copies. This is like the thing I gift to my mother-in-law. Like it is beautiful, and I'm so glad that there's another volume on the way. So with that, I will turn the time over to Darlene. Really excited to hear what you have to share with us, Darlene. Thanks for being here, and thanks everyone for being here.
Great, thank you. Just make sure my screen share is working okay. Are you guys seeing my PowerPoint here? Everybody nod your head so I can see. Okay, good. So, Rachel, I wanted to ask you, I'm familiar with Zoom. I've taught on Zoom, but I'm lousy at noticing hands being raised. So
Oh,
will
I've
you
got you.
be,
Yeah,
okay, you be
I've
my
got you.
little moderator. I'd appreciate that.
Yeah,
Because
and
I
I
just
mean, chat is also really great. If you want to jump in, I'll be looking at both. So,
thank you, because
yeah.
I'll just be rolling with my stuff, and I would really love to hear from you guys. So if you see something, Rachel, that you'd like to bring out, I'd really appreciate that. Okay, so we're going to talk about how you describe spiritual experiences or bear testimony or talk about the spirit in your literary art without being cheesy or propaganda-ish. And I like to use that word propaganda because I think it helps people understand that you can go over the top either way. So, for example, when I was the editor, poetry editor for Dialogue, I had so many submissions of poetry that I didn't want to publish because they were propaganda, not just for the church, but also for other, against the church, or for other variations that the writer wishes the church would make in their policies and their culture. And it's just as soon as you start getting into trying to persuade or complain or preach, it doesn't matter which end of the spectrum you're on, you've left the domain of art and you've gotten into propaganda. So I wanted to kind of talk about that. And I hope you apply it not just to spiritual experiences, but to anything you feel like you want to sort of preach about, and how you can pull back from that and instead try to create an artistic experience that leaves room for people to feel the spirit or to feel moved by what you're saying. So I want to start by just thinking about what what we use art for. I don't know about you, but if I want to be preached at, I go to a different source than art. So I have to think about what really is the purpose of art when I'm setting out to write something. If, and I tell my students, if you feel really strongly that you need to preach about this cool thing you learned, or help everybody see how they're wrong in some certain way, that's great, and they should write about that, but they shouldn't call it art. It shouldn't be a personal essay or a poem. It should be a sermon or, an op-ed or some other genre. So for me, the reason that I go to art, and I'm having a hard time getting my slides too fast. There we go. For me, one of the reasons I go to art is because when I read something that is really well crafted, it makes me feel less alone. I feel empathy with the writer or with the character that I'm along with. And that character might be the writer herself in a poem or in a personal essay, or it might be a character in the novel. But when it's done well, I feel, oh, someone understands me. Like they've been there too. Another reason is it helps me feel closer to God. I can feel the spirit when I feel truth in something that I read. But it has to be told in a really truthful way and not in a kind of pushy, preachy way. And then I just like how art helps me feel more in general. Like it just creates an experience for me and increases my capacity to feel. I don't think it's accidental that the word aesthetic that we use to describe art, its opposite is anesthetic. If you think about it that way, anything that makes you feel less is anesthetic, but we're shooting for aesthetics, things that invite us to feel. The best art creates an experience for the audience. They can enter it and they can go through the process of it over time as they read it, and they can feel things. When they get done, they may not even be able to paraphrase everything that happened because something happened to them. And it's kind of private, and it's kind of just this thing that happens over time. So my humanities textbook from back in the dark ages when I went to for my undergrad degree, I loved how they talk about art, and they emphasized that really at the bottom of the art experience is basic human needs. You think, well, what kind of needs? And this is what they say: the need for confirmation of our inner perplexities. The need to be reassured that inner ambivalences, doubts, and anxieties can be given shape. These needs are so much a part of our humanity that they function at an unconscious level. And I think this is true, that one of the things that art really can step in and do that other kinds of writing can't is to speak to the fact that really life and the universe are not black and white. We don't experience everything as in happily ever after and really obvious wrongs and rights. We have these inner perplexities, these ways that people fall short, or even sometimes our dogma falls short, our beliefs fall short. And art can step into that gap, which is, I think, the best thing about it. Virtuous or morally good art is art that tells the truth about experience in a way that respects the audience's agency. I think there's two important things to note about this definition that I made up myself about morally good art is that it tells the truth about the experience. So you don't want to lie and make things out to be the way they are not. And one of the ways we might lie is to ignore those gray areas and those gaps and those inner perplexities. And the other thing to point out is that it has to respect the audience's agency. So I'm going to talk about both of these things. We believe that free agency is one of the highest moral goods. So important, in fact, that it inspired a war in heaven, and we fought for it. So how do you show that you're respecting free agency in your writing? One of the ways is through your characters. So you want to make sure that your characters are making a wide variety of choices with a wide variety of outcomes. So if you have only good characters and only bad characters, they're all just flat or stereotyped. That doesn't feel true to life. And if you have only their actions lead, if they tell the truth, then they get the prize. And if they don't tell the truth, then they don't, then you're not telling the truth about how the world works. And I would say that they're not acting as if they have free agency. And I believe that readers can pick up on that. So another way that you respect free agency is with your audience. Let me back up just a second. I think I missed one in here in the middle that I would say free agency for you or for your the persona that you create as a writer, either, you know, that's speaking in a poem or that's speaking in a personal essay. So when it is you speaking, that persona or that character that you've created for yourself can also demonstrate free agency or not. So for example, you want to have a persona that is free to rage or to preach or to lie or to do all of these things, but you also want to, when they do those things, speaking of yourself, I guess, when you do those things, put it in a context that shows the whole spectrum of human behavior and of your own worldview. So, for example, if I have a poem that's kind of preachy, I'm going to put it in a collection next to a poem that's kind of grumpy. And so that's kind of showing a wider perspective, is showing me as a deeper person and really kind of demonstrating free agency in its contrast that, you know, there's not just one channel that I'm gonna do. And I think that's what makes the best personal essays as well. They're not gonna just, I'm gonna start here and I know where my destination is, I'm gonna go straight there. But they're gonna embrace some kind of wandering and maybe even some gaps that allow the reader to, you know, jump over something that isn't outright hammered straight on. And that request that gets to your audience's free agency. When you have gaps and you don't hammer it, that also means that you risk losing your audience. If you have a really crazy metaphor, someone may not come with you on that trip. But I think that's what makes better writing, because it has that risk in it, and it even has the freedom for your audience to not quite get there with you, and that's okay. So I think that makes for more moral and better art. Okay, also, I just want to say too that you just don't want to shut down your reader's ability to interact. I guess that's just another way of saying not slamming it into their heads, but just leaving this space so that they can get themselves there. Okay, the other thing I added to the bottom of the slide is just the whole truth. So we talked about respecting agency, but also you need to tell all of the truth about experience and how the world works. So I've just kind of thought through the sorts of ways that we need to make sure that we're telling the whole truth about the way the world works. So in one way, it's the truth about experience. For example, there really is evil and pain and complication in the world. So if I'm writing a, you know, a book and I don't let any of these things in, everybody's just happy and all the good people live happily ever after. I'm not telling the truth about the world. We all know people who do everything right and their lives are just really, really hard and miserable. And we know people who aren't living the way we would like to preach that they should live, who seem to be doing okay, seem to be pretty happy in this life. And we can argue, well, deep down, they're not really happy. But you know, the truth is that you can get a lot of pleasure living outside of a moral code in this life. And if we don't show that and just the complexity of that, we're not telling the truth about how the world works. I also think, though, if you're only ever talking about the darkness and you're only ever complaining, you're also not telling the truth about how the world works. There's many things that can be celebrated, and you can be preachy on both ends of the spectrum, as I said. Also, there's doubt. If you are straight out bearing testimony without even showing that there's a place for doubt, you're not telling the truth about faith. We know, you know, according to Alma, faith is not perfect knowledge. In fact, as soon as somebody has perfect knowledge, that's the end of their faith, he says. Implicit in that to me is that it's not faith unless there is some doubt or some questioning. And so I think that's beautiful. I love to celebrate that. So if I claim that I'm trying to build faith with my writing, and yet I act as if there's no doubt, even among the most righteous and committed characters, or my most righteous and committed poem, if I don't leave any of that tension in there, I'm not telling the truth about experience, and I'm not telling the truth about faith. Again, on the other side, if I'm only writing about doubt and the inability of us to access truth and neglecting to talk about wonder and mystery, I feel I'm still not telling the truth about experience. Things don't always work out in a way we can see. We know that's the truth. We see that all around us, but we just don't see it enough around us in religious art. I just would like to see more of that in our faithful, which means including doubt, religious literature. And then, of course, we have to tell the truth about faith, which I just talked about. And I just added sugarcoating things excludes people from the experience because they recognize it's not true. It just doesn't feel true to people. They might feel that joy of a happy ending. And you know, I watch my little British police procedurals because I love knowing they're going to solve it in the end. Like, there's a place for a satisfying, happy ending. But I would argue that the more resounding the satisfying, happy ending, sometimes the lower on the art scale the piece of art is. So we're enjoying it, you know, for all its vicarious rewards, but it's maybe not as artistic. So same thing again, if you've got this complaint to make about how things are going, if you're constantly vilifying or stereotyping or all or nothing claims about anything, gospel culture or anything else, that also excludes people from the experience. They just don't feel that it is true. It doesn't resonate to their experience. Okay, so the key is to see how you can get tension. I really think art requires tension. So you want to make sure that you include it because it's not going to feel true if you don't. And your audience will be less engaged because they're not feeling that it's true and therefore they're not moved. So therefore it's not artistic. But the question is, how do I get a sense of tension if I want to preserve this sense of faith or talk about spiritual things in a way that is moving to people spiritually? But also, if I want to maintain tension, how can I still try to bear testimony or include some sort of spiritual feeling in what I'm doing? And it is hard. It is tricky. And let me just say one more thing about tension. If you think about what you love about music, for example, a piece of music that has no dissonance at all is not enjoyable, right? And in fact, some people go to certain kinds of music, jazz, for example, just for the joy of that tension. You know, the blue note that doesn't quite resolve or that's up against the note you expect, or syncopation. You know, it's the tension and the playing with what you expect and seeing how it varies from what you expect that makes the thing enjoyable. Or fiction. What is fiction without conflict? You just don't have a story. You think about how, if you get done describing something that happened to you today to your spouse or your best friend, and they say, "Well, at least now you'll have a story to tell," you realize that phrase means something bad happened, right? Something went wrong or against expectation. That's what made it a story. It wouldn't have been a story without that. So you really do need that tension. Same with personal essays. If you don't have a sense of questioning, if you're just slamming it in, it's not art anymore. It's just a good church talk. Okay, so how to do it? I have some ideas. So the first one is to defamiliarize it. The artistic technique of presenting to audiences common things in an unfamiliar or strange way so they could gain new perspectives and see the world differently. So, think about that. You're going to try to set into your art the thing you want to share in a way that makes people pay closer attention. So you're going to take it out of the way they're expecting. You know how you tune out in a church talk because you know exactly where it's going to go. So you're going to try to get people's attention by making it strange. So one possibility would be to apply the thing that you want to talk about in a different way. So here's an example of what I'm talking about. This is a poem of mine where I took the whole scenario of the Garden of Eden, which I love to come back to. I think it's so rich for art. And I used it, I applied it to a modern situation, which was a lady I had to work with at work who was making me feel like work was not the Garden of Eden. I'll say it that way. So I just wanted to apply, make a point, kind of. I'm preaching to myself in this poem, but I felt like applying this, all right, why we did have to leave Eden, to my situation with this lady at work. I didn't know it meant you, the lady at work, the saccharine rural accent and big hair, the burnt egg gossip by which you scribble boredom in the overcooled air of our endless snarling buzzsaw days together. I am meant to love you. I am meant to picture an invisible pain inside you, the cause of your caustic small talk, snide gratings and whines, but I can't. I picture you as a high mileage Buick with bald tires, pitiful and heavy and still moving. I picture you lonely. It doesn't help. Daily, I bark my shins on your edginess. Why can't I break your orbit, scrabble free from your tack? The world is like this. The world is a gunky barbecue, a sagging bumper, fretting dogs in the distance, hangnails and scraped palms, splinters in the skin. I signed up for this when I ate that fruit back in the garden, that boring, gentle garden. I hadn't known that this would be the adventure, this torque and tonnage of dailiness, leaden and dull, intermittent toxin, sporadic sublime. Looks like the only way back to the garden is to harrow it out here between us, my accidental guru, my vivifying thorn. Okay, so we talked about having a new, just applying something in a new way. Another possibility would be how you use metaphor. So this is one of my favorite poems from Anne Sexton, and she's talking about her relationship with God, but she comes up with this metaphor for her dance with testimony or lack of testimony. Listen to this. On with it, he says, and thus we squat on the rocks by the sea and play, can it be true, a game of poker. He calls me. I win because I hold a royal straight flush. He wins because he holds five aces. A wild card had been announced, but I had not heard it, being in such a state of awe when he took out the cards and dealt. As he plunks down his five aces and I sit grinning at my royal flush, he starts to laugh, the laughter rolling like a hoop out of his mouth and into mine, and such laughter that he doubles right over me, laughing a rejoice chorus at our two triumphs. Then I laugh, the fishy dock laughs, the sea laughs, the island laughs, the absurd laughs. Dearest dealer, I, with my royal straight flush, love you so for your wild card, that untamable, eternal, gut-driven ha-ha and lucky love. I feel like I'm constantly rewriting this poem because it has got under my skin so much. I love that she casts Jesus as this card shark that's got an ace up his sleeve, and it's a great metaphor and it works for me. It leaves space for me to enter it and decide what it means for me, and a great way to put tension without being cheesy. So here's my little suggestion for you. And I don't know, maybe we don't have time to like actually do this, but ponder what you would do. What kind of metaphors can you come up for how God interacts with you? And if you were my students in my class at BYU, I would set a timer for 5 minutes and I would make you come up with a list. And you would write for 1 minute and think you came up with everything you possibly could. And then the second and the third and the fourth and the fifth minutes would be absolutely excruciating. And by the end, because you know me and that I'm going to come around and get mad at you if your fingers stop typing, you will be frantically looking around the room for random objects that you can keep adding to your list. But the funny thing is that it's those things at the end that end up being the most interesting. They're crazy. You're just throwing stuff out there. God and me, it's like going to get a bad haircut. God and me, it's like crossing the street in high traffic. God and me, it's like a stray dog that needs to be put down. Like you're just randomly putting stuff out there, but then you go back and say, really? Like, a bad haircut from God? Or am I God? Or am I the person in the chair? Or am I the person giving the haircut? Like, where is God in the scenario? Like, you can come up with all sorts of stuff if you let yourself go crazy making lists. How about metaphors for how you reach to Him? What is it like to reach out to him? It's like trying to pick a donut from the case, and you know you shouldn't be eating donuts anyway. I don't know, I'm randomly going off on stuff. But think, let yourself go crazy and be random and see if you can come up with crazy metaphors. How about metaphors for what the spirit feels like? I mean, this is where we're going to skip over the warm fuzzies and the warmth spreading from your heart and the still soft voice and all those random things. And maybe you could come up with something really different. I'll show you an example of something really different in a second. What's a metaphor for what the loss of the spirit feels like? Maybe the loss of the spirit is like you're picking out a donut and they're all stale. I don't know. Play with it. Come up with some wild and crazy things. Set a timer and make a list. Okay, another one is just embracing surprise and play, which I got into a little bit with that, coming up with lists for metaphors. Try to go for the crazy thing or the unusual thing or something that is surprising. So here's an example of one I did. I'm not going to read the whole thing. Make me an instrument of thy peace. So I just wanted to come up with a surprising instrument. And, so I play with it could be an instrument like a tool that somebody uses, which is, I'm sure, what was meant in the original metaphor. Or it could be an instrument like a beautiful flute or a violin or something like that. But that's boring to me and obvious. So I wanted to push to something surprising. So the last stanza, moving into middle age, I begin to see the joke and joy of what you've made of my life. Yes, your breath has been in me. And on days I manage to flatten myself thin enough, translucent as waxed paper, I vibrate, resonant in your wind. You humming through me, curious timbre, ticklish, tangy, and strange. Good enough. I'll be your holy kazoo. Salah. I love thinking about that. And that's how I feel too. I'm awkward. I am not a violin. I can maybe be a kazoo for God. And I think that's probably what he expects of us, is to be the crazy, weird instrument that we are and not the instrument that really well put together lady in our relief society is. Okay. All right. So, by the way, when we talk about making things strange, I love to think about Emily Dickinson's Tell the Truth, but Tell It Slant. Just coming up with a new way, a surprising way that's different from what everyone else would come up with or think about. Strange juxtapositions. So this is one of my favorite poems from Morris Manning. And I've got this, my slide, I can't even see it all here. I've got you guys covered up. Let's go back. But I love how this is kind of similar to what Anne Sexton does. He's come up with this metaphor, and in his whole book, which I recommend, Bucolics, he's got this voice that he's taken on of this kind of down to earth, kind of like a farmhand sort of feeling, which is, I'm sure, comes from the title Bucolics. But listen to this voice. I've got one thing to say to you. That's blackberry winter boss. Your little cool spell in the spring, your dewy days so lingering, you're fiddling with the sun, you slow the season down, you pull the reins, you lay a whoa on everything, as if you want the dawn to last until the dusk, as if you want to taste the dawn a little longer. Oh, I don't blame you, boss. The dawn is sweet. Who wouldn't want to hold it back? I like it when you hold me back. I like it when you jerk the reins. I know the gee or haw, if either comes, will come from you. Ooh, I just love that passage. And I recognize that feeling. Like when I feel God reprimanding me, it's different from when I feel Satan on my back. Satan says, "You're trash, you blew it again." And God says, "I think you can do a little better, and here's an idea." And I feel like it's a sweet reprimand because I know he notices me. Like he's involved in my life. And man, Morris Manning does it so well. I like it when you jerk the reins. I know the gee or haw, if either comes, will come from you. Oh, such a great way to bear testimony with this weird, strange voice. Here's another one. Angels of Mercy, this is mine. It's just the weird juxtaposition. So we've got Relief Society, we've got a nice council together where people are deciding how to serve a sister who's in need. But I just wanted to juxtapose it with the crazy conversation in the world about plastic surgery and about women and women's bodies, and just to tie together those two situations, a sweet group of ladies who want to serve each other, but also who are weak and maybe have a sense of judgment. And then this tension of how do we all feel about our sisters getting plastic surgery or about us getting plastic surgery? So maybe I'll just read it. The Seventh Ward Relief Society presidency argued long and soft whether Janie Goodmanson deserved to have the sisters bring her family meals. It seemed that precedent was vague. No one was sure if boob job qualified as a legitimate call for aid. Janie herself had never asked for help, a fault they found harder to forgive, even than the vanity behind the worldliness of D cup ambition. But in the end, charity did not fail. The sisters marched on in grim duty each evening, clutching covered casseroles, for after all, it wasn't the children's fault. More than once, though, by some oversight, the dessert came out a little short, as if by some consensus they all knew that Janie's husband Jim could do without a piece of pie that night. Just having fun juxtaposing those two things together. Okay, another way, come at it from the edge. So sometimes a topic is just really big and really hard to come into. And I experienced this when I was asked to write some poems about the life of Jesus for an art exhibit that was going on at BYU. I usually stay away from really big subjects because it's super hard to write a good poem about a big subject. Good poetry includes a lot of really concrete, specific details. And that's why some of the poems that we hear read over the pulpit, like intellectually, they make sense and they might even be enjoyable because they have end rhymes. But they don't really touch us because they're so abstract. You know, you read a poem about the atonement, it's got these big words like atonement, and it's hard to feel where does that touch ground? Where does that touch my life? And so I like to kind of stay away from really big subjects for that reason, but they asked me to. So I just set myself the task of how to come into a big subject, and I decided the best way, especially if I was going to talk about the atonement, was to come from the edge, and I'll show you what I mean here. This is just a section of my poem called Gethsemane. I want to tell the story, but there's no approaching this strange crux of everything. Come at it sideways, come at it from the edge. So I'm just like, maybe I can just enter the situation a little bit from the edge. I can't talk about how Jesus felt because I don't know. So I have to find some way to make it touch ground for me in a personal way. Picture then a hard scrabble patch of land, rocks, an olive tree, sparse, straggling desert grass. The rocks have been waiting. The wind has been waiting. The living souls nearby sleep through the whole thing. This is important. I have slept through many things. And then what can be known? There has never been any moment more private nor more public. So, what I know, the screaming, windy cliff of unavoidable onus, the weight of what must be done. For me, it was the abyss of being about to give birth, the way the self shrinks to a pinpoint in a vacuum, the way one becomes lost, faceless, the way the thought that there's another soul depending on you can pull you inside out and through to a new place. But of course, even in that, my most impossible moment, he was already there, having been there before me. So I just had to find a way to make it be about me, I guess, because that's what I know and that's what I can talk about. Okay, so how can you describe a spiritual experience from the edge? Think about a possible different orientation. Maybe that would be like taking another angle on what you want to describe. So I compare this to like when you hear the remake of a song, an old favorite. Like I heard, you know, I'm a child of the 80s, and I heard a remake recently of the Eurythmics song, Sweet Dreams Are Made of These. And the original, you know, it's a rock song, it's got a strong beat, but the remake I heard was very, it was slowed way down. It had a different singer with a really airy voice and great dramatic pauses between each phrase. And it was just a total new piece of art that was covering this old. And you can do that too. If you've written something, an essay or a poem, and you realize it's just not got enough tension in it, you could take a different angle. How can I slow down or speed up? How can I put a different voice? Can I appropriate a whole new set of language? Like, Morris Manning did with his bucolics, you know, bringing in some sort of this speaker that doesn't even punctuate. Like, what are the ways I can cover this song in a new way? So that's one thing you could try. Another is, can I change point of view? Like, I've told the whole thing from my perspective in first person I. What if I changed it and told it as you or she? What does that do to the poem? And I will often do this. I'll take a whole poem and change the whole point of view and see which one I like better. Another thing is just change the speaker. What would this poem be like if it was spoken not by the person who is experiencing the thing, but someone near them, someone who watches it happen? You know, play with that. See if that would be another way to access something really big. You could also move your camera lens angle. You could be telling it really, really close moment to moment, or you could pull way back out and summarize and tell things over a more a grander scheme. A wider lens is what I would call it. You could just pick a different timing. So you could describe this experience as it's happening, or you could describe it in retrospect. Or you could use would. I love would to jump to the future. Later, I would realize. Later, I would have a dream. Or later, I would and put it into future. Try that. Play with it and see if that helps. The most important thing, I think, is just being specific. Anyone can argue with sweeping statements that you make in the abstract, but no one can argue with you being really, really specific to your own experience or telling really, really specifically a believable character's experience. And entwined in this, of course, is what I was saying about concrete, specific details. The more specific you can get, the better experience you're creating for your reader. So this is just an example of one of my favorite stories that describes a spiritual experience, Jack Harrell's Tregenz Medal. And in this story, he has this character who's a teenager who decides to go to a rock concert by himself because his friend backs out, and he doesn't have a ride, or he drives himself. But as he's driving along, he sees somebody hitchhiking off the side of the road, and he feels really bad for this guy. He looks kind of run down, so he stops and lets him in. Turns out this hitchhiker that he picks up is Jesus. So this teenager and Jesus go to the rock concert together. Jesus says, "Can I come along with you?" So they go together to the rock concert. The whole story is about Jesus and Tregen enjoying this rock concert, and later how Tregen decides to talk about what happened to him with other people. But I just love that this character Jesus comes along with Tregen to the rock concert. Later in the concert, the band launched into a Tout Le Monde, a song about a man saying goodbye to the world at the end of his life. Jesus leaned over and shouted over the music, "Dave wrote this song during a really bad time in his life. I think playing the guitar was the only thing that got him through it." Then inspired, Tregen touched the sleeve of Jesus' t-shirt and felt, as he viewed the stage, the audience, the building around him, a sense of how painful life was, more hurtful than anything he'd ever known, and at the same time mingled with joy too great to bear. Now, if we took just that last paragraph and put a different kind of story around it, I would say that's so cheesy. But he can get away with this because we are at a rock concert, a heavy metal hairband concert. Like, I feel like him being super specific to the situation of this teenager and where he might feel Jesus is what saves the story from being cheesy. It's just that specificity, and we believe it that this might be the way this kid could feel Jesus and meet him in his life. Finally, being less sure. It's just, if you're so sure about everything, no one can access that. There's just no way to get into it. One of the major blocks to creativity is the feeling of knowing you are right. When we think we are absolutely right, we stop seeking new information. To be right is to be certain, and to be certain stops us from being curious. Curiosity and wonder are at the heart of all learning, so the feeling of absolute certainty and righteousness causes us to stop seeking and stop learning. Emily Dickinson, she says, "I dwell in possibility, a fairer house than prose, more numerous of windows, superior for doors." Ah, I love this. I think it's such a great description of art. Art has windows and it has doors. It doesn't just, you know, have walls, a closed box with all the answers. It lets people in and out, and it respects free agency. My favorite testimony from the Book of Mormon: "I know that God loveth his children, nevertheless, I do not know the meaning of all things." I like to flip it around. There's a lot of things I don't know. I can still bear testimony to the fact that he loves his children, and I can do that in millions of ways. And I can do it in ways that, because I'm willing to admit I don't know the meaning of all things, makes it accessible, doesn't slam it down anybody's throat. There's more things you can brainstorm if we had time. You can do later, maybe. What are some of the things you know for sure? The thing that maybe you want to bear testimony of, but then think, what's a really, really specific, maybe surprising, maybe unexpected, interesting situation that I could describe this thing through? I'll pick, if I want to bear testimony that I know God loves all his children, I'm going to pick someone really strange and weird and possibly unlovable, maybe. You know, what's a really, the unexpected situation would be a surprising context to describe this knowledge through. What's an interesting way I can apply this to something else? Then I'll set my timer and make a whole bunch of metaphors for it. Just wanted to say, I think God's the perfect example of creativity and of a teacher because of his valuing of free agency. You think about how Jesus taught in parables and sometimes even directly, but to a whole, let me say it this way, a very small percentage of the souls that were going to experience life on the earth. I mean, you think any time he was teaching in one place, there were millions and millions of people in another place he wasn't teaching. And yet he is good with that. Like he calls his work good. So there's got to be more to just slamming a message into someone. To the way he teaches. So if we can look at that about he lets people come to him when they're ready, and he teaches them in their own language and through their own specific experience. Finally, Kate, I'm just going to read you one more because I like to end with my testimony. And this is my testimony. Each morning, God saunters over to me, shy wallflower, and boldly extends his hand. We dance. Sometimes I put on my flared skirt and polka at the picnic, reel at the barbecue, but some days I drift about in stained sweatpants, slumping against him like a 15-year-old with mean parents and a curfew. Still, every morning he shows up, jerks his head meaningfully towards the dance floor, and I keep reaching out my hand. Each night he returns me, singed and yawning, but sometimes summons me 3 hours later for the meteor shower, fussy baby pajama, hokey pokey. I will hell yes. I will hail dance, drum circle. That's for you, Melanie. Even as my heavy feet and heavy heart stumble, no, with each systole, I will diastole back, yes, tush push and boot scoot, yes to the twirls, yes, even to the heart dropping dips, the chicken walk, holy Macarena. Okay, that's the end of my presentation, but I'd love if we have. Looks like we have a few minutes. Any of you guys have things you want to share or questions?
Thank you so much, Darlene. What, and I'm so glad that we got to hear some of your poems and also some fabulous guest poems in here. To kick us off, we've got two questions that have already formed. The first one, Heidi and Renee have asked if you could say a little bit more about the speaker and the audience agency. And Alma asked a question about, like, what are the limits of like metaphor? Like, when does the metaphor go, like, is it possible for the metaphor to go so far that it just fails and is too absurd or too flat? A rough paraphrasing of those two questions.
Okay, so speaking more about agency, I don't know if I can say any more than what I did, but so I'll just reiterate a little bit. I think that means that not being willing to risk that they won't come with you where you were hoping they would. And this is tricky because you don't want to, what I don't mean is accept sloppy writing, right? I have students who they write badly. I'll frankly say it. They write badly and then they say, well, it's your fault for not getting it. Like if you were smarter, you would get what I was getting at. And that's a problem. But I think you can write very expertly and well and still leave it possible for someone to misinterpret something. And I think if you're working so hard to guarantee that they won't misinterpret, you're slamming it down their throats and you're making it less artistic. So, for example, my favorite metaphor for poetry is that poetry is to Poetry is to prose as dancing is to walking. So if you think about if you wanted something really badly, I'm starving and I have money in my pocket, and right over there is Cafe Rio, and I've even got a 2-for-1 or a free, free horchata. I am going to get over there to Cafe Rio as quickly as I can. So in this metaphor, the destination is the meaning you wanted to share. So if you care desperately about getting your reader to that meaning, you should write in prose. You should write something very direct with as clear and transparent language as you can, because what you care about is them getting it. So you're creating an op-ed or a church talk. That's great. Let them get there as fast as you can. But with poetry, you care more about the experience. You're going to take your time getting there, and you're going to dance a little bit on your way. And you may get so caught up in the dance that you don't even get there. There's poetry out there that's purposefully there to get you so stuck in the language that you don't even know what the meaning is. And the poet's done that on purpose. That's the experience they're trying to create. So there's different levels of people's aesthetic preferences about how transparent they like language and poetry, and sometimes we call that accessibility. But there should be some sort of dancing with language and some sort of experience happening along the way where you are willing to risk that someone may not get your full meaning, and yet you're creating this dancing experience for them anyway. I don't know if that metaphor worked for you. Speaking of metaphors, the other question was about metaphors. So one of the formative books that I read as I was getting more serious about writing is a book called The Art of Recklessness by poet Dean Young. And in it, he just kind of preaches the benefit of being more reckless in our poetry. And I like to see that. I think if you are not opening yourself up to something that surprises you or some kind of wildness in there, you're risking being boring. But the backside of that risk is that someone may not get what you meant by a metaphor. But I would rather see someone being more risky with their metaphors than not risky enough. I would say be careful about like using totally inept, but and I don't mean INEPT, I mean INAPT, if that's a word, metaphors that are not apt. So for example, she had such a musical voice, it sounded just like the sound that a dog makes when it throws up. Right? That's not an appropriate metaphor. That problem with that isn't that it's, I could say they're embracing the wild and the unexpected, but it was inapt. Like it didn't fit. So you want to go for the surprising thing, but not the inappropriate thing. And there's something else I was going to say about that. Dang, it's gone. Anyway, go for the wild. Oh, this is it. Robert Frost. He says, "No surprise for the writer, no surprise for the reader." So let yourself be surprised as you're writing too. Be less tight-fisted about where you're sure that you want the piece to go. Let yourself be open to surprise. Okay, other questions?
We've got about 2, 3 more minutes for questions, and then I'll share the closing thoughts document with a whole bunch of exciting opportunities going on this month in our
I have a
community.
question.
Yeah, Melanie.
Hey, Tony. Thanks, Rachel. A quick question about your process, Darlene, about so do you start with the spiritual experience in mind that you're wanting to write about, or just talk a little about the process for you when you start a poem that has this kind of focus, if you don't mind?
That's a good question. I try really, really hard not to start with a spiritual experience in mind. I try to start with something else that's really grounded and quirky and specific and interesting, and then see where it leads me to, and let the spiritual experience come in if it's going to. Just by my nature, I tend to find I have to push against actually the tendency to bring in something spiritual to every poem. It just kind of happens. But if I did want to specifically bear testimony, if there's something spiritual I really knew that's what I wanted to write the poem about, I would do that work I described of brainstorming interesting contexts and surprising metaphors and surprising juxtapositions, I would say, where can I set this, or what weird character can I put this with, just to put that tension in there, because I need to find some way to get some tension in there, or I don't feel like it's artistic.
Question. Great answer. Is there one more burning question out there? And if you're shy, you can put it in the chat. This has been a real masterclass. Oh, sorry. Someone about to ask a question before I go off on my fangirling. Okay. Well, if someone's got a question, interrupt me in my fangirling, but describing spiritual experiences. I mean, writing's already hard. Writing about spiritual experiences is so hard. And all of us, regardless of where we're at on the spectrum of religiosity or spirituality, Exponent is very much this feminist forum for women and gender minorities across the whole spectrum, and all about diverse experiences, regardless of what someone believes or where they're coming from. Like, this very thing to transcribe the spiritual is so hard. And so, darling, I think it's particularly amazing that this is the intersection where you're at in the community, and how beautifully you're able to do this time and time and time again. Because it is hard. It is really hard. Cynthia's got one more question for us. Oh, wait, I think we've got two. One real quick one. Emily asked, have you put your poem Inheritance in any of your books? Which one, if so?
I don't think I have. That's an older one, and it would have been in Homespun, but I don't think it is. I was it published in, I think it was published in an old Sega Law. We could find it in Sega Law somewhere, but I
Yeah.
don't think it's in any of my books.
Yeah. Okay. Well, she's just flagging that. And then Cynthia asks, do you have your own standard about defining spiritual versus sacred? And then thanks, Kaylee. Yeah, it's on the spot.
Ah, interesting. So, do you mean I'm going to assume that what you're talking about is by sacred, like something that maybe shouldn't be talked about? Is that what that question is regarding? Who asked that? Can you come on and tell me if that's what you meant?
Yeah, Cynthia, feel free to unmute if you want.
Hey, I'm here. I even have my pirate hat.
I love you guys.
That's great.
Sometimes when we want to express a feeling, that's something that we say is spiritual, but other things we don't talk about, and we say they're sacred. And sometimes those are very powerful and important experiences to write about, but do you have a definition that says I never write about anything in the temple, or I never write about manifestations of the spirit?
Yeah.
How do you look at it that way?
I guess everybody has their own lines, but for me, there are very few things from the temple that I think we are specifically told we cannot share. And if you look, the church is now producing a lot of stuff that shares a lot of things from the temple. So I feel like unless it's something that I have committed not to share specifically, that I can share it. Things that are very tender to me, I approach with great reverence, or I don't write about them at all. But in terms of feeling like I'm naughty for talking about something, I don't worry about that. I feel like God, he wants me to share my testimony. So I'm going to, and by testimony, I mean my worldview about how the world works. And we all have our own testimonies. And I even, unless I feel it's private to me, sacred in that way, I don't hesitate, other than the things that we've promised we shouldn't say. And that's not as much as we think. So I have poems that use language from the temple. I'm thinking of one in particular in Homespun and Angel Feathers that when the students were assigned to read that book in their LDS Lit class, I could tell which ones hadn't been endowed because they raised their hands and asked me, what in the world is that talking about? And I was like, I guess you haven't been to the temple. But I feel confident that I'm not going to reveal something that I've promised not to, and otherwise I'm okay with it.
Thank you so much, Darlene. That actually reminds me, one of my favorite poems in your first volume is about the locker room at the temple. Like, not like I am here at the pinnacle moment of this, it's just like in the locker room. I love that. I love the specificity that you bring to so many of your experiences that make them more universal to people. I put this in the chat, but here is our closing thoughts document for the night, and we'll send you all on your way. I know we've got a lot of time zones, and we've also got a lot of new people. And so, again, just want to say thank you so much. This is a bi-monthly workshop. We have a craft session every first Tuesday of the month, and we have a generative session the third Tuesday of every month at 9 Eastern Standard. And we've been going for a while now. This is our, yeah, it looks like this is the 28th craft session, and we want to keep it going. We really are about democratizing these writing skills. Like, clearly Darlene has been doing this to an expert level, and so what a gift to be able to learn from her. And so we want to keep sharing that. So if you are inclined, if you could subscribe to the magazine, we're in our 50th year of publication this year. It's so exciting. And we also have a monthly newsletter. It's not spam. You get it like once a month, and it's packed of all kinds of opportunities like this. Recommend you signed up. There's also a Patreon and different things. I've just highlighted in yellow what I'm going to cover in depth here. Darlene's books. She's got three, and the next one is coming out March 18th. That's just around the corner. Darlene, we need to get you some pirate clothes. Like, I need to be hearing about your launch. Really, really excited for you and excited about this cover too. Signature is lucky to have you. And then just a few other things I just want to name. If you have work that you'd like to submit to the Exponent blog, in fact, Julie just posted like earlier on this chat thread that one of our pieces has been published this month. So exciting. Always looking for blog posts, always looking for content there. And also the magazine's open for submissions. It's an open theme. Here's some great Facebook groups. Some of you came from, MoPoWriMo. This is a good one. Make sure you familiarize yourself with the standards and expectations of kindness in that group before joining. It's such a wonderful treat every February. So here's a few, few other things. And then last, because Melanie brought this up too, and I've highlighted it here, Segula is having their contest for fiction, nonfiction, poetry, and visual art. So a wide spectrum. And there's a few other things. I'm gonna make you motion sick looking through all this. We've got Mormon Lit Lab. Everyone, I've decided that every like Mormon and Mormon adjacent space is like put something up for to be due this month. So go have a party. If would you be willing to share those slides, Darlene? I'm like, this recording will be saved in our files, but
Yeah, I'm willing to share my slides, but I think this comment here was about those last few slides with your great announcements.
Oh yeah, you can download that. I'll put it in the chat one more time. You can make a copy of it or download it. And we always have one of these every time we meet. So well, this session is recorded, and Darlene's great slides are on that too. But just, we're 1 minute after the hour, and want everyone to just have a wonderful rest of your night or day, wherever you're coming from. And thank you again. Huge round of applause for Darlene. Thanks for being with us today. Take care, everybody.
Thank you, everybody.